Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. We're going to split this hour into two, spend a half hour talking with Steve Bright about the prophetic record of Nostradamus. Maybe you've heard from someone that, man, I'll tell you what, this guy predicted everything. And there's more to come. He's got predictions all the way out until the almost into the fourth millennium. We'll find out whether or not his predictions hold water in the course of this half hour. And then in the second half hour of this second hour, we'll be talking with Jennifer Roback Morse. She's author of that book. We've talked about it several times here on Issues Etc. Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. We'll talk about a new study about the children of single parents with Jennifer Roback Morse. In the third hour of the program, open lines for your questions, your comments. We'll talk about a number of things. I've got stuff that's been piling up because there's been so much news kind of on the top of everyone's mind with regard to the UN resolutions, with regard to Iraq, with regard to Colin Powell, with regard to just war. Well, lots of other things to talk about during open lines, anything you want to talk about, and we'll round off that hour of open lines talking with Douglas Johnson, legislative director of National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C., about judicial nominations, human cloning bills, and bills that would ban partial birth abortions. And for those cloning and partial birth abortion bills, there are also phony ban bills to be considered as well, even as the Senate at this point is wondering whether or not it will mount a filibuster against Miguel Estrada, someone who's seen as a possibility for the first Hispanic appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court off in the future. We'll talk about all of that during open lines in the third hour of Issues Etc. Steve Bright is assistant editor of the Christian Research Journal. He's author of an article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Nostradamus, A Challenge to Biblical Prophecy. Steve, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Glad to be here.
Well, congratulations to you. I understand they've even got a picture of you, for heaven's sakes, on the editor's page. Elliot Miller must have bumped himself. You're much better looking than Elliot Miller, I should say.
Well, you know, if you put that picture in your window, I think it might scare some of the cultists away.
Well, so you have a new position there as of October as assistant editor of the Christian Research Journal.
That's right. That's right.
You also have an article here on Nostradamus. Tell us who Nostradamus is, or was, I should say.
Well, he was a French doctor. He lived in the 16th century, which would place him right around the time, right at the height of the Protestant Reformation. He was born in 1503 and lived about 63 years. And he was actually a doctor by profession, and just to give you an idea, think about all the religious wars that were going on, the factions, all the political intrigue, and all of that provided all sorts of material for his prophecies. And what he's most well known for is a book called The Centuries. And it was completed in 1558, and it contains almost 1,000 prophecies, and he wrote these prophecies. They were four-line poems called quatrains. And this book was written mostly in French, and it covered the time period from the 16th century to the year 3797. And those, I think there's about 940 to 948 prophecies in that book. That's what he's most well known for, and that's what most of the books on the bookshelves are written about, are those quatrains.
And how would you describe the nature of the so-called prophetic statements made in this book by Nostradamus?
Well, it's an interesting combination of French terms, Latin terms, mythical Greek figures, historical allusions, all sorts of unique words, anagrams, odd spellings, puns, odd syntax, odd word order. One of his followers called it, I like this quote, a massive verbal jigsaw puzzle. That's probably the best description I've read of it.
Well, before we take apart some of the predictions and those who buy into his predictive power, their interpretations of these poems, what does Nostradamus himself say about these things? Did he intend them to be taken as prophecies?
It's very difficult to know how serious he was about these. He made certain statements that seemed to be tongue-in-cheek. He also seemed to make statements about those people that he lived among. He called them barbarians, the people who didn't understand his prophecies. And it's kind of, it's really interesting to discuss his motives. So we don't know necessarily from what he wrote whether he was serious about it or not. There's some, you know, there's room for doubt. And but as far as the prophecies themselves, what he said about whether they would be understood, he claimed that they would be understood. One of the quotes that is in the article is that from Nostradamus was, "For although they are written under a cloud, the meanings will be understood."
Did he claim any divine source for these prophecies?
Absolutely. At the time, it was not... you could come under the wrath of the church if you messed with astrology at all. So, of course, when he wrote in public, he would claim that the source of his prophecies was God and profusely claim that it was all from God and in accordance with the Catholic faith. It's always mixed. Whenever he mentions that, it's always mixed with the source of astrology. So he mixes up his sources. Sometimes he claims it's from God. Other times he always claims it's from God mixed with astrology.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We can evaluate that. If he claims it was from God, of course, we can look at Deuteronomy, and the test for a true prophet is whether his prophecy comes to pass. So if he lays it out there as from God, then we have every right to test it by seeing whether it comes to pass. And if it doesn't, then Deuteronomy says that prophecy was not from God.
Well, there are a lot of people, Steve, who have read Nostradamus over the centuries and believe that they have found fulfillment of his prophecies and would contend that they have come to pass. And there are many of them, even though we are some centuries removed, many of them who are avid fans of Nostradamus and watch the newspapers for the next of his prophecies to come true. You write that one of the chief characteristics of his prophecy is ambiguity. That would seem to work in his favor then.
Absolutely. Even his ardent followers will admit that he was ambiguous. Like I said, the phrase "a massive verbal jigsaw puzzle" was from one of his most ardent followers. And it's very much like any of the soothsayers or astrologers of today, like Gene Dixon. They come up with a system which works on ambiguity, and the misses are ignored, and the few hits that they happen to have rise to the surface. And when you make 940 prophecies, a few of them are going to look like hits. They can be twisted. If there's a few phrases in there that might match some historical event, then, you know, the other phrases in there are sort of ignored or twisted to fit. But it definitely does hinge on the ambiguity, and I think that's one of the reasons we have to question his sincerity. He claimed at one time that he was actually trying to help the masses. Well, if you're going to try to help the masses, why would you write something that's so ambiguous that no one can untangle it?
Give us an example from Nostradamus himself.
Of a prophecy that would be difficult to untangle,
or one that people have claimed to have found a direct predictive connection.
Probably the one that I use in the article is a good one to start with. It's probably his most famous one was when he predicted the death of the king at the time, French king Henry II. The quatrain reads. The translation of it into English reads, "The young lion will overcome the old one on the field of battle in single combat. He will burst his eyes in a cage of gold, two fleets won, then to die a cruel death." Now, they will apply that prophecy to King Henry, who was in a jousting competition, which they equate the phrase "a field of battle in single combat" to a jousting competition. The young lion will overcome the old one. They apply that to the person that Henry was jousting with. He's the young lion, and, of course, Henry's the old lion. But, of course, neither one of them used a lion as an emblem, so there's really no specific connection to that. What happened was the person he was jousting with, the Count of Montgomery, his lance shattered, and a piece of that lance went into King Henry's eye. and killed him. Well, it didn't burst his eyes, as the prophecy says. It went into his brain, actually, and killed him. It didn't burst his eye, but two fleets won, then to die a cruel death. There's no connection at all to that event. The phrases basically are too ambiguous and not specific enough. And here's what's important. Lots of prophecies are ambiguous. Even prophecies in Scripture are ambiguous. The problem is that Nostradamus' fame rests on the claim of his followers that they have found specific fulfillment of these predictions. So the burden of proof rests on them to demonstrate that it's specific. And when you actually sit down and examine their interpretations, you find that they violate all sorts of rules of interpretation to yield these proofs. So they basically do not support their own case. It's not the case that we have to demonstrate that no meaning exists. The thing that has to be demonstrated is what they claim.
Our guest, Steve Bright, is the assistant editor of the Christian Research Journal. Now, if you'd like information on how to receive the Christian Research Journal, you can call them toll-free, 1-800-2-JOURNAL. That's 1-800, the number 2, journal. Or you can check out the Christian Research Journal on the Internet by visiting first our Issues Etc. website at issuesetc.org. Click on the Links with Regular Guests link, and you'll find a direct connection to Elliot Miller and the Christian Research Journal. The phone number again, 1-800, the number 2, journal. You mentioned the methods they use to interpret, or the methods that they don't use, really. They don't use solid literary methods to interpret the text of Nostradamus' prophecies. What exactly do they do with these texts in order to get the kind of predictive connections they claim to have found, the followers of Nostradamus?
They come up with all sorts of literary devices that Nostradamus supposedly used to obscure the text. It might be anything from a legitimate device like an anagram, which is jumbling the letters in a word or a name to look a little bit differently, and then we would rearrange those letters into a name. That's a legitimate device. But what they'll do is also allow that we can take letters out, we can put letters in, we can change letters, we can mix two or three words together as a part of an anagram. And what that does is provides a pretty large number of opportunities to find some sort of a fulfillment. For example, I like this example. If you take the name Nostradamus, there are 11 letters in that name. In those 11 letters, there are almost 40 million possible combinations. If you could rearrange that into several words or other names. Now, with 40 million possible combinations, and with the time period over which he made his over which his prophecies covered, there's got to be some event that might come close to that. And that's generally what they'll do. They'll twist the text just enough to match some event, but it will always violate some principle of a sound interpretation.
So in other words, the text of Nostradamus' so-called prophecies are used really kind of as a wax nose. Bend it here, bend it there, whatever fits the headlines of the day, so to speak.
I like that analogy, a wax nose.
Now, did Nostradamus claim to be making infallible predictions, or did he say, look, I'm just your average kind of prognosticator. I might get 50% correct.
No, that's what's interesting. He claimed both, actually. He, on one hand, he said, I cannot fail, err, or be deceived. And another time he said, these events will occur infallibly. Those were his words. But on the other hand, he would claim that he could make errors. And he asks in one place that the king forgives him if he makes any errors.
So there seems to be some inconsistency here in his own claim.
Absolutely. There's inconsistencies all through about his claims to clarity. On one hand, he'll say they could be understood. On the other hand, he'll say that they can't be understood. So, yes, there's inconsistency. And wouldn't we expect that?
Now, there are a few, and you mentioned at least one in your article, predictions of Nostradamus that actually attach to particular dates. There's one having to do with the year 1999. It even says in the seventh month, from the sky will come a great king of terror to bring back to life the great king of the Mongols, before and after Mars, to reign by good luck. What have people made of this, and does it fit?
That's probably the most recent dated prophecy, and they've applied it to the Antichrist, the phrase, the great king of terror, that's supposed to have come from the sky in 1999. It's been applied to the Antichrist, nuclear war, a giant meteor, a solar eclipse, the beast of the apocalypse, and of course none of these came from the sky in 1999, but that doesn't seem to slow any of the Nostradamians down.
How big of a following does Nostradamus still have? I mean, I'm not so much talking about only the enthusiasts, but people who, via the internet or via the books, the many books that have been published, say, well, you know, he was your a pretty good 17th century prophet.
I think it's, a lot of people don't really know much about him. They might see a program on PBS or some special, or watch a movie or something. There was a movie out a few years ago, and a lot of that is very, very Hollywood. So the facts are twisted in those as well. But people have bought into some of the propaganda and haven't really weighed any of the facts. And that's relevant because many people have heard that. And they might, when someone says that biblical prophecy is accurate, they might respond and say, well, what about Nostradamus? Now, a lot of people might have that sort of a knowledge about him. There are probably not as many who are deeply into him and have read him and understand him, that type of thing. So I think it's probably pretty pervasive that people would wonder and say, well, what about Nostradamus? Didn't he make a bunch of prophecies that came to pass?
Well, is what's good for the goose good for the gander? In other words, should Christians be as concerned about an accurate reading and a lack of manipulation with the text of the followers of Nostradamus, as or with the Holy Scripture prophecy, as they are with Nostradamus? If we're going to criticize the followers of Nostradamus for manipulating the text, for reading things into the text, for changing things around, shouldn't we also criticize it when Christians do the same thing with biblical prophecy to try and make it fit the headlines?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. And there are people who do that. And that's kind of a secondary issue. I don't really address that in the article, but that was what got me interested in Nostradamus in the first place. If the interpretive methods of his followers are correct, if that's a legitimate way to interpret prophecy, well, then we can do that with Scripture, too. And you're correct that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If it's no good for Scripture, then it's no good for interpreting Nostradamus either.
Now, we recently had a series of cataclysmic events in our country. The most recent, of course, Columbia, the space shuttle Columbia, broke up on reentry September 11th, and then people are reminded poignantly this week about the Challenger disaster. Are there followers of Nostradamus who claim to find each of these things in his writings?
Sure. That's what just about every big event that comes along, they'll try to connect somewhere. especially on the Internet, it's amazing. Especially after 9/11, there were several fabricated quatrains that people took pieces and parts from other quatrains and put them together to match the event. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily say anything about Nostradamus' legitimate prophecies or, you know, ones that were actually his. But, again, the burden of proof is on these interpreters to prove, to demonstrate from the text that it could only mean, or that it could only apply to or refer to whatever particular event it is. For example, during the Challenger space shuttle disaster, they applied quatrain 181 to that. But the first line of it says, nine will be set aside from the human flock. Well, now they've completely ignored the fact that there were only seven crew members. So, you know, they'll twist the rest of that thing and ignore the fact that they're talking about, that he was referring to nine and there were only seven. Well, they have to demonstrate how that nine is referring to seven. and it's there that they'll twist the text.
One last question before we go, with only about a minute to answer. How should Christians who want to continue to hold to the veracity and the accuracy and the infallibility of scriptural prophecy, how should they deal with then the claims of Nostradamus?
Just consider them for what they are. They're ambiguous, and they rest on the spurious interpretations of his followers. That's the best way to view it.
Steve Bright, thank you very much for being our guest.
Sure. Glad to be here. Thanks, Todd.
Steve Bright is assistant editor of the Christian Research Journal, author of an article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Nostradamus, A Challenge to Biblical Prophecy. You know, someone says to you, if I can prove that Nostradamus wasn't accurate, then I can also prove to you that the Bible prophecies aren't accurate. Put them to the test and make sure that we use solid interpretive methods, not the kind employed by the followers of Nostradamus. There are all sorts of claims out there being made all over the place. One of the biggest claims within the Christian church in the last 30 years has been the promise of exponential growth if you simply follow the principles of the church growth method. Now, those claims, those promises, have been put to the test in a new book that we have adopted as our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. It's called Testing the Claims of Church Growth. If you'd like to get the book for yourself and examine the claims of church growth in light of Holy Scripture and the facts, you can call Concordia Publishing House in the next half hour, that's how much longer they're open, during regular business hours, and order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. The phone number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also order the book online by going to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. When you get there, click on the What's New section, and you'll find additional information on how to order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. Go to our website tonight when you check your email. Very easy. You can do it any time of day or night. Issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section and order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. The number for Concordia Publishing House during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Now, when we come back from this break, we'll change a complete change of subjects. Is the single-parent family simply an alternative, an equally valid alternative to the two-parent family? This has been claimed for a long time, that children are really no worse off with a single parent. Maybe they're lonely for mom or dad, but they're really no worse off with a single parent than they would be with both intact. Is that claim true? Do the statistics bear up that claim? When we come back, we're going to be talking with Jennifer Roback Morse. You may have heard her at other times on Issues Etc. She's author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. We're going to talk about a new study about the children of single parents. Now, it's a reality there are single parents, but what are the consequences, and in fact the consequences for future generations of children raised in single parent families? And when we come back, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. After Jennifer Roback Morse, we'll have an hour of open lines.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
St. Paul writes, I have become all things to all men, so that by all means I might save some. Now, does this mean that St. Paul was an advocate of marketing the church? The modern church growth movement answers yes, but in the new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, its author, Pastor Rod Zwanitzer, says no. You can order Testing the Claims of Church Growth by calling Concordia Publishing House during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Testing the Claims of Church Growth. Or you can order the book online at our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find a link to Concordia Publishing House, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Stuart Shepherd. A coalition of conservative and religious organizations has put together a manifesto on the sanctity of life. The document will provide a framework for lawmakers and the White House to show the importance of human dignity. David Brody reports from Washington.
With today's rapidly developing technology, there seems to be an assault on the preciousness of life every day. Bioethic experiments range from designing your own baby to putting patents on human cells and genes. The future is indeed scary.
We're facing a brave new world, biotechnology, which will be out of control unless we control it.
Nigel Cameron serves on the Council for Biotechnology Policy. He says the manifesto lays out the battle plan.
We're concerned not simply with the abortion issue, which is not going away and is a huge issue, but we're concerned with a broader picture. And we want those in government to be very well aware of our vision for human dignity and how important it is.
To that end, the hope is that Christians and all Americans will wake up and see the dangers out there. Chuck Colson, president of Prison Fellowship Ministries, says the alternative is not good.
You're going to suddenly wake up one day and realize cloning is a way of life, genetic engineering is a way of life. We're basically creating the future generation ourselves.
Which raises the bigger question of humans trying to play God.
What's being presented in this whole biotech thrust is the question of what it really means to be human. Who decides?
The manifesto will be used by conservative organizations to develop educational materials and prepare Christians all over the world for the dangers that lie ahead. For Family News in Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
Another concern is genetic discrimination. Eventually, your genetic information might be available for your employer to look over. Senator Sam Brownback has pledged support for the manifesto, along with Family Research Council, Concerned Women for America, and Focus on the Family. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
When the Civil War ended in 1865, more than 4 million slaves were set free. From 1936 to 1938, writers conducted interviews with more than 2,000 one-time slaves. Unchained Memories, Readings from the Slave Narratives, an HBO documentary brings the words of these former slaves to vivid life. The Missouri Historical Society is hosting a special free preview of Unchained Memories, Sunday, February 9th, at the Missouri History Museum in Forest Park. For more information, contact the Missouri Historical Society. Are marketing principles compatible with Christian evangelism? Find out with the new book, Testing the Claims of Church Growth, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Testing the Claims of Church Growth is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New. Testing the Claims of Church Growth, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Single parenthood is a fact of life. There's no doubt about it. It is something with which every institution in our society is having to cope. And it is not likely that single parenthood is going to go away anytime soon. Now, with no eye cast askance at a single parent who is in that situation beyond for reasons beyond their control, we do have to ask some hard questions about the results and the impact of single parenthood on children, because after all, parenthood does involve the kids. We're going to do that for the remaining 25 minutes of this hour of Issues Etc. Jennifer Roback Morse is our guest. She's author of the book that we've studied here on Issues Etc. before, Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. She's a research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Jennifer, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
The rest of you can join us. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. There's some new data out on children of single parents. Tell us about it, Jennifer.
Well, yes, there was a study that came out a couple of weeks ago based in Sweden, of all things, where they studied single-parent households compared with two-parent households. And what they found, it was a very extensive study of kids in Sweden, and what they found among the adolescents was that the adolescents in single-parent households were twice as likely to attempt suicide and twice as likely to abuse drugs or alcohol as were the kids in two-parent families. Now, that's particularly striking because, number one, it comes from Sweden, and for years we've all been told, gee, if only we were more like Sweden, we'd be able to have a more free society with people being able to be single parents and so forth. All we need is more money and more social supports. for the unmarried mother, and everything will be fine for the kids. So now it turns out that even in Sweden, where they have all of these social support networks in place, it turns out that the kids are still having problems. So that's a very striking result, Todd.
And is there a reason to, any good reason to say that the effects that single parenthood is having on the children in Sweden can be transferred in some sense to our situation, different as it may be?
Well, you see, this information really just corroborates what we already knew here in the United States. We're getting results like that. We have been getting results like this from the United States, studies done here for a long time. In fact, our studies do something that this Swedish study didn't do. Our studies in the United States have looked at the impact of whether the couple is married or not, whether the kids have are part of a step family or not. And when you break the data down that far, as we do in a lot of our American studies, you find that kids in families where the couple has been married continuously do better than kids in two-parent households where there has been cohabitation or where there has been a step-parent kind of situation. So get married and stay married, as the church has always taught us, turns out to be the best thing for the kids. And this information from Sweden is really just adding to the information that we already had here from America.
Of course you understand, Jennifer, that you are, in making statements like this and in drawing attention to conclusions like this, even of the Swedish study and of our own, what we know here in America, you are flying in the face of conventional wisdom. You are like Don Quixote tilting at windmills here.
Well, but you know, these particular windmills are really important to fight, I think, because there's so much human misery attached to it. And I think if people have more realistic understanding of marriage and its alternatives, I think it would be very helpful to people in making better choices. So I think there's really no alternative but to speak as forthrightly about this sort of thing as we can.
You have said that there is no such thing as a single parent. What in the world do you mean?
Well, what I mean by that, Todd, is that every woman who is raising a child apparently by herself actually has the help of a lot of other people standing behind her. It's just that when she's not married, the persons helping her are not a spousal relationship, not a husband, not a family member, but things like her commercial daycare provider. Her employer provides her with money to pay the daycare provider and to support the child and so forth, and perhaps she has some support from the government, from public assistance. But the point is that no one can really take care of a child completely by themselves, because you got to take care of the child, and then you got to take care of your other material needs. Somebody has to take care of who's ever taking care of the baby. So what we really are doing when we say single parents, what we really have is unmarried mothers who, instead of having a relationship with a child, they have substituted a series of impersonal commercial relationships for a personal spousal relationship with a man.
Now, this is intriguing, and I know that that is also part of the thesis of your book, Love and Economics. And really, the substitution of impersonal social institutions for the husband.
Right.
Does it work the same for the single dad?
Well, you know, the single dads haven't been studied as much, okay, because there simply aren't as many of them. There are different issues that come up with a father-only household, and there are different issues that come up when a child is completely cut off from their father as well. So you have different kinds of issues when the child has a father substitute as opposed to having no father at all or no father figure. So there are a whole variety of things that come up, but they're not studied as thoroughly as these other points that I'm mentioning.
Okay, so back to the single mother. If the single mother is substituting for the absent husband father various social institutions and other things, impersonal things, what is the economic impact on the rest of us with regard to single parenthood?
Well, I'll tell you that and this is something that the Swedish study makes real clear. If you're talking about something that doubles the probability of a person abusing drugs and alcohol, right? You're talking about something where you're going to end up with social costs attached to that. You know, this particular study didn't look at these issues, but there's also a higher probability of being involved in the criminal justice system. That in the United States is a very robust result, where study after study shows that kids in single-parent households are about two to three times more likely to end up in trouble with the juvenile justice system. If you look at kids who are in juvenile hall or in the juvenile justice system somehow, some 70% of them are from either single-parent households or no-parent households. So what that means, Todd, is that the expense of trying to control people who can't control themselves, that is spilling over to the whole rest of society and has a lot of costs to other people. So if the children are not either being properly supervised so they get into trouble, or they aren't properly attached to their parents and therefore don't have a conscience develop the way it should develop, if those kinds of things happen and you end up with criminal behavior, that's expensive to everybody. And we're feeling this very acutely here in California because we have a big budget deficit, of course, at the state level. And the governor is cutting every program in the state except for one, prisons. We're building more and more prisons in the state of California because we've got more and more people to put in them. And when you look at it that way, you know, you see that it really isn't just a decision. The decision to bear a child on your own is not something that only impacts you. It can have ramifications all across the board if you're not careful.
But the claim has been, and you know it better than I do, that single parenthood is both economically and societally neutral, zero impact kind of a thing.
Yeah, and that's just not true. I mean, I don't think that position can be sustained any further because the impact on the kids is so serious, you know, that the kids end up, they're more likely to be poor, they're more likely to drop out of school, they're more likely to be depressed and unhappy, you know. So all of these things add up to costs that spill over onto other people. And I think it's well for people to have a more realistic idea of what they're getting into if they choose to have a child without getting married in the first place, or if they choose to dissolve their own marriage. They're putting something into motion that is going to reverberate through the generations of their family. And it's really a much bigger deal than we have been thinking up until now, I think.
It wasn't too long ago that some studies, and they really hit the press in a major way, some studies about daycare and the impact of daycare on children were drawing everyone's attention. What's the relationship between that kind of study that showed a negative impact of daycare on children and the studies that show a negative impact on children with single parenthood?
Well, the way they're related is that in both cases, what is lacking for the child is relationship. You see, that taking a child and putting them into institutional care is a situation that is sometimes depriving them of real personal care that is attentive to building up the relationship between the mother and the child and the father and the child and building up the relationships inside the family. And when you have a disrupted household or a never-forming household so that the mother doesn't have any relationship with the man or that there's a contentious relationship between the spouse, between the father and the mother, those kinds of things also are disruptive to the child's ability to form and maintain relationships. And so all of those things, the problem with each of these things is the same problem. It's more severe when you have a kid who's been in an orphanage and never had any parental attention. That's more severe than putting a kid in daycare 40 hours a week, of course. You know, and in between there, you have all of the different kinds of dysfunctions that the family can get into. But I think the thing to track in all cases is what are these lifestyle choices going to mean for the child's ability to be in relationship with other people. That's the thing I think we need to keep our eyes on. For so long, we have looked at it in terms of more material resources, and we've said, you know, if the children have a high-quality daycare setting, it'll be fine. If the children, if we could just get enough income to the children of single mothers, everything would be fine. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a high-quality daycare, and there's nothing wrong with having more money, but the point is that's not all that's needed. I mean, the really fundamental thing that children need is stable, loving, personal relationships. And if you've got that, you can survive poverty and you can survive a lot of other things. But if you don't have that, you're really at risk for a lot of other stuff. And I to me, that's the message. That's kind of the big picture message of this whole body of work.
At the same time, are you equally concerned about the family where there are two parents but the parents are working so much, and I think you alluded to this,
right,
that daycare is the effective, and in terms of time, the home where and the family this child enjoys right. or doesn't enjoy.
Right, right. And, you know, I have to tell you that the studies about daycare are not as strong, I guess you could say. They're not as strong and as conclusive as the studies about family structure. So we know for sure that being in a single-parent household has all the negative effects that we talked about. When you look at daycare, the studies about daycare are kind of all over the place. You'll find some studies saying that there's no big deal, and you'll find other studies saying that it increases aggression and all sorts of stuff. And I think the reason for that is that when you're looking at families that use daycare, you have some families that are the way you described just now, that where the parents are really quite self-absorbed in their own careers and their own work, and the kids are really being institutionalized. On the other hand, you have families that use daycare in a much more thoughtful way, you could say, when the kids might be in the daycare, they might be in the very same daycare the very same number of hours, but the parents view the whole thing differently. It's more the idea, what is the best thing for our family at this time in this situation? And it's not, instead, oh my gosh, I've got to work, we've got to make this mortgage payment, I've got to work, I've got to have daycare. See, I think if you go at it with that kind of attitude, if you get yourself into that kind of financial bind where that's what you have to do, I think it changes a lot of the dynamics inside the family. And, of course, those are things you don't track very well inside a study, a professional study like this, but I think it's something that your listeners can be very much aware of as they make their own family decisions. You know, you can monitor that very carefully, and nobody knows that but you and your spouse, whether you're working for your ego or you're working because you really need the money, or you're putting Junior in daycare because you think he needs the social development, or you're putting him in daycare because you just want to get rid of the little booger. You know, you have to pay attention to that yourself as a family, but I think those things are really much more important than we've given credit for.
Our guest, Jennifer Roback Morris, will be one of the speakers at a conference that, and I want to give you a heads up about this, folks, a conference that's titled The Christian Mind and the New Millennium, that's going to be held April 4th through the 6th in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Other speakers at the conference include Chuck Colson, Dr. James Dobson, and others. Now, if you'd like information on this conference, The Christian Mind and the New Millennium, April 4th through the 6th in Colorado Springs, Colorado, call this number toll-free, 1-888-672-0007. That's 1-888-672-0007. Jennifer, in the minutes that are left to us, you've got a story to tell. You are an adoptive mother. Tell us about that, and what have you learned?
Well, that was like the great saving grace of my life, the great miracle of my life, was that we had two children in 6 months' time, which is sort of miraculous, I suppose, even for a Catholic to have two kids that close together. But we adopted a little boy from a Romanian orphanage, and he was 2.5 years old when we got him. And then 6 months later, we gave birth to a little girl. And my plan had always been that I would, when I had children, I would just be a good career woman and pop them into daycare just like all my friends did. But when we got this little boy from the orphanage, it became very clear that he needed much more personal care than he was going to get in any kind of daycare or even nanny care kind of situation, and that what he really needed was to attach to me. He needed a mommy, you know, and he'd already had plenty of institutional care. And what we learned from watching his development and watching our daughter's development is we learned just how important the first 18 months of life are, not only for the child in particular, but for the whole society, because it's during that 18 months of life, the first 18 months, that children lay the groundwork for the development of a conscience. And this was very surprising to me because I'm an academic, and I tend to think things through rationally and reasonably and all this kind of thing. It turns out that the conscience development has more to do with relationships than it has to do with your reasoning faculty. In other words, you have to be attached to other people. Other people have to matter to you before you even give a darn about right from wrong or doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you are not in a relationship, if you don't know how to be in relationships, you don't care about other people. You don't care about what they do to you. They're not even real to you, in a sense. And so it turns out that relationship work that new mothers do automatically and naturally is essential for creating a free society where people can go about their business pretty much unbothered by others and pretty much unbothered by the government. Because if you don't have people with a conscience and people who can control themselves, you can't be free. You can't have a free society. You're going to have policemen on every corner to monitor everybody. And I think we're finding this out now more and more as we see some of the more spectacular examples of childhood killers, you know, and childhood criminals. When you look at their stories, you inevitably find some kind of disruption in their family, sometimes very serious disruption. You know, for instance, we have this Beltway sniper kid, this young kid that went along with Mohammed, what's his name? I've forgotten these guys' names. Anyway, I think you know who I'm talking about. That guy was abandoned by both parents, and Mohammed became his adoptive father and kind of took him around and said, wouldn't it be fun to blast people, you know? I mean, these are kids with very disrupted attachments, very disrupted relationships, and when you think about how much fear those two men instilled in a whole population of people, it's really quite striking that we need people who can follow most of the rules most of the time voluntarily. And that's what I learned from adopting a badly neglected orphan. I just realized that it was going to take a lot of work on our part to bring him back to some kind of normal functioning, and that he really should have had that in the first 2 years of his life.
To those who would say, and there are many who would, you know this, Jennifer, who would say that the two-parent family is quaint and good and fine if it works, you know, if you want to live that kind of 1950s Ozzie and Harriet thing, but society's too complex, it's too fast-moving, the needs of the family, the mobility of people and the divorce rate, all of these necessitate that we simply get used to single-parent families, maybe even the norm someday. Your response?
Well, I think that's like saying, you know, there's so much air pollution, we should just learn to live with it. You know, we should just learn to walk around with masks on our faces because, you know, I mean, the industrial society demands that we spew all this stuff into the atmosphere, and so, you know, get over it. You know, I think that's a very defeatist mentality, and I think that people who have actually been through divorces will tell you that this was not like a great fun episode in their lives that they would really like to repeat, you know. And so I think that it's important to see that there are alternatives to divorce and that what you do actually matters to other people. I honestly think that when we believe that it's just a matter of me and my husband and what we choose to do, it's very easy then to kind of throw in the towel and say, well, you know, I'm not happy, forget it. But when you realize that there's a lot hinging on what you do, that the way you treat your spouse is an important contribution to the whole culture, then I think it makes it, it helps you to see your marriage in a new light. It helps you to see that lifelong love is a great, noble adventure, and it's worth doing. It is, of course, costly. We are not all going to look like June Cleaver, you know, and be happy and always have that smile painted on our faces. We're going to have trouble. We're going to have problems and difficulties, but it's worth the effort, and that the way you treat your spouse is your contribution to the culture of marriage. And if you are abusive to your spouse, either in word or deed, you're contributing something negative, you know. And if you, on the other hand, are kind to your spouse, if you overlook their faults sometimes, if you bear patiently with their faults sometimes when that's called for, and if you put this institution of the family as a priority in and of itself, then you're contributing to the good of marriage. You're contributing to the whole overall health of the culture. And I think that people, if people can see that what they're doing affects more than just themselves, I think it helps you to see that it's worth the effort.
I'm going to take my family as an example, and by way of summary of our conversation. One dad, one mom, a girl and a boy as kids. And we got a dog in there, but she doesn't count. Is there something about me, not personally, but me as a male parent, father, husband, and my wife as the female mother, wife, that is together important to both of our children, regardless of their gender, both of our children and their development?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think you know that's the case, that at different times in a child's development, they get different things from each of their parents, and they need different things from each of their parents. I mean, for instance, it's been shown that when parents divorce, it's often the boy who suffers the most, who has a greater tendency to be depressed because of the absence of his father and everything else that's involved in divorce. But it's often the girls who will do more sexual acting out. That the presence of the father helps a girl to have kind of a, what do we want to say, have a good sense of herself as a young woman and how she should be treated by men, you know, and what she should expect from men and that sort of thing. So there's different, when you remove one parent, different kinds of things happen to the kids of different genders. And that suggests to me that you really need both the father and the mother. Now, I'll take my own family as an example. Something that was absolutely shocking to me is that the stereotypes are true, Todd. What can I tell you? I was the one who wanted to snuggle and cuddle and keep the kids comfortable, keep them happy, make them happy.
You've got about 30 seconds here, Jennifer.
My husband wanted to bounce them around, and he's the one who wants to insist that they behave. And I could not believe how hard it was for me to make them uncomfortable for their own good. And I really needed my husband to do that for us, for both of us, for all of us.
Jennifer Roback Morse, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Jennifer Roback Morse is a research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution and author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. If you'd like the book for yourself, you can call Spence Publishing toll-free, 1-888-SPENPUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. You can also order the book online at SpencePublishing.com. It's all one word, SpencePublishing.com. Now, if you order Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work, and you mention Issues Etc., Spence will give you a 50% discount on the book. The number again, 1-888-SPENPUB, and the website, SpencePublishing.com. When we come back from this break, we've got an hour of open lines. Not so much, really about 45 minutes of open lines, and then 15 minutes to round it all off with Douglas Johnson, legislative director for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. We'll talk with him about several issues at the end of that hour, but before that, it's open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll talk a little bit about what Jesus would eat, and believe it or not, yes, after what Jesus would do and what Jesus would drive, there's a book out telling us what Jesus would eat and telling us that we should eat it too. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.